Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Late-night hosts call for gun control following Las Vegas attack by Jennifer Kalfas. Consumed by Americans each night after a long workday, late-night television shows are often a source of levity and comedy. But after instances of tragedy, late-night comedians often take a more serious tone to use their platforms to make statements or calls to action in a move that has become all too familiar. Such was the case on Monday night as late-night hosts responded to the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history with calls to action to end gun violence in the U.S. On Sunday night, a gunman identified as 64-year-old Stephen Paddock opened fire on tens of thousands of people at a Las Vegas country music festival perched from the window of his hotel room. At least 59 people died and 527 others were injured as concertgoers tried to escape the area while law enforcement and ambulances rushed to the scene. Politicians, celebrities, and people around the world shared their condolences for victims, their families, and all those impacted by the massacre, and some cited the tragedy as reason for gun control in the U.S., and many late-night comedians did the same. Jimmy Kimmel immediately began his monologue in tears as he lamented the tragedy in Las Vegas, his hometown. "We wonder why, even though there's probably no way to ever know why, a human being would do something like this to other human beings who are at a concert having fun and listening to music," Kimmel said, choking up. "It's interesting because when someone with a beard attacks us, we tap phones, we invoke travel bans, we build walls, we take every possible precaution to make sure it doesn't happen again," Kimmel said. "But when an American buys a gun and kills other Americans, then there's nothing we can do about it." Kimmel, who like other late-night hosts noted the frequency of these attacks in the U.S., showed images of each senator who voted against a bill that would have closed loopholes in the law that allow people to buy guns under certain circumstances without going through a background check. The bill was considered last year after the mass shooting in Orlando. "Maybe I'm nuts, but I'd like to think we could put politics aside and agree that no American citizen needs an M16, or 10 of them," Kimmel said. "And maybe that way we don't do this again." Stephen Colbert, perhaps the most cited late-night critic of President Donald Trump and his administration, made a plea directly to the president to enact gun control legislation. "You want to make America great again? Do something that the last two presidents haven't been able to do. Pass any kind of common sense of gun control legislation that the vast majority of Americans want," Colbert said. Colbert noted how last week House Majority Whip Steve Scalise returned to Congress after a near-fatal shooting during a congressional baseball practice over the summer. "His return after his long recovery," Colbert said, "was a kind of moment that gives you hope that Congress might work together for the common good. The bar is so low right now that Congress can be heroes by doing literally anything," Colbert added. "Doing nothing is cowardice. Doing something will take courage," Colbert said. "But you know what? It took courage for people at that concert last night to help each other as bullets flew. It took courage for the first responders to rush in and do their jobs. It took courage for people of Las Vegas to simply go about their day today." Seth Meyers opened late night by lauding first responders, blood donors, and law enforcement, among many others, for their efforts of aiding the victims of the attack. "It always seems like the worst displays of humanity in this country are immediately followed by the best, and then, sadly, that is followed by no action at all. And then it repeats itself," Meyers said. He went on to say that no matter how tragic the mass shooting, some politicians shy away from discussing gun control as a possible solution to prevent these recurring tragedies in the U.S. "To Congress, I would just like to say, are there no steps we can take as a nation to prevent gun violence?" Meyers asked. "Or is this just how it is and how it will continue to be? If it's going to be thoughts and prayers from here on out, the least you can do is be honest about that," he said. Conan O'Brien. Conan O'Brien said one of his producers stood outside his office Monday with a file full of the remarks he made after the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012 and the Orlando nightclub shooting in 2016. The need to make these statements, said Conan, who has been hosting late-night shows since 1993, has grown immensely over the last decade. For me or any TV comedy host back then to come out and need to address a mass shooting spree was practically unheard of, Conan said. But over the last decade, things have changed. How could there be a file of mass shooting remarks for a late-night host, he asked. When did that become normal? When did this become a ritual? And what does it say about us that it has? Saying he's not one to get political, Conan echoed his statements from the summer of 2016, when more than 40 people were killed at Pulse nightclub in Orlando. I don't think it should be so easy for one demented person to kill so many people so quickly, Conan said. The sounds of those automatic weapons last night are grotesquely out of place in a civilized society. Something needs to change. It really does. Trevor Noah. The Daily Show's Trevor Noah spoke of his experience living in the U.S., where he said 20 mass shootings have occurred since he moved here from South Africa. Noah pointed to how some political figures, including in this case White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders, say in the immediate aftermath of a mass shooting that it is not yet the time to discuss gun control. When is the time? And also, if you say after a mass shooting is never the time, then you'll never have the conversation in America, because there's a mass shooting almost every single day, Noah said. So when is the time? To the people of Las Vegas, I can't give you thoughts and prayers, Noah said. I can only say that I'm sorry. I'm sorry that we live in a world where people will put a gun before your lives. James Corden. James Corden opened the Late Late Show by mourning the victims of the Vegas attack and lauding the first responders and blood donors who immediately took action to help others. Last night was the biggest mass shooting in the United States history, Corden said. That's a record that's been set twice in just the 2.5 years that I've been living in America. Corden, who lived in the United Kingdom before the U.S., said he comes from a place where far fewer mass shootings occur. And in America, he said, that should not become normalized. Gun violence should not be a staple of American life, Corden said. Some say it's too early to talk about gun control. For those victims last night, it's far too late.
Not just Catalonia, three more places with dreams of independence. By Ian Bremmer. Self-determination is in the air. We began last week with a Kurdish referendum in Iraq, and we ended it with a raucous Catalan referendum in Spain. Neither may amount to much, at least in the short term. But hope is a hard thing to extinguish, as separatist movements around the world can tell you. Here, three others holding out hope in 2017. Biafra. A country of more than 250 ethnic groups, Nigeria declared independence from Britain in 1960, but a couple of military coups in 1966 stoked underlying ethnic tensions. In 1967, southern groups, led by the Igbo people, one of Nigeria's three major ethnic groupings, declared the Independent Republic of Biafra in Nigeria's south. Nigeria refused to recognize the breakaway state, and a 3-year civil war ensued. All told, more than 1 million people lost their lives, many due to starvation. Biafra surrendered in 1970. But defeating a secessionist movement on the battlefield is a far cry from defeating its spirit. And nearly half a century later, the dream of Biafra remains alive. These and other nationalist currents continue to make Nigerian politics choppy, as does a president whose frail health has the country continuously on edge. Southern leaders have rejected secession calls as impractical. But the movement for Biafran statehood is still considered enough of a threat that the Nigerian military declared the Biafra separatist movement a terrorist group just a few weeks ago. Harkening back to a simpler time when just wanting a homeland of one's own was enough to be labeled a terrorist. Flanders. Belgium's largest political party, the center-right New Flemish Alliance, is actually a secessionist movement, highlighting just how fragmented Belgian politics really is. Belgium is divided into three: Flanders in the north, bordering the Netherlands, predominantly Dutch-speaking, Wallonia to the south, bordering France, predominantly French-speaking, and the Prussian's capital region in the relative middle. Modern-day Belgium has its roots in 1830, when France supported a brewing rebellion in the southern Netherlands. Wallonia was the favored region then. Today, power has shifted to Flanders and 60% of the country's Dutch speakers. In addition to language and culture, economic inequality in recent years has widened the divide. While Wallonia's per capita GDP is only 88% of the EU average, 2011 figures purchasing power standard, Flanders' GDP per capita is 20% above, 2014 figures purchasing power standard, a sticking point for Flemish residents who see their money being sent to parts of the country that literally speak a different language. For now, the Flemish independent movement has been slow and plodding by design. When the time comes for a referendum, which would be the first on Flemish independence, that strategy may make all the difference. Donetsk and Luhansk. It feels a lifetime ago since Vladimir Putin's top worry was Ukraine moving too far west. It was actually 2013. To recap, pro-Russia Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych rejected a deal to strengthen Ukraine's integration with the EU, touching off violent protests in Ukraine. These protests eventually ran him out of the country, and an enraged Putin invaded Crimea in response. But to really paralyze Ukraine's movement toward the West, seizing Crimea wasn't enough. He needed to sow discord from within the country, which is why he stoked the pro-Russian independence movement in the eastern provinces of Donetsk and Luhansk. But Russia doesn't really want Donetsk and Luhansk to become part of Russia proper. Instead, Russia's real power move is trying to get the Ukraine to change its constitution to give provincial leaders, like those in Donetsk and Luhansk, more power over national security and trade policy, vetoing any future outreaches to the West. Complicating matters even further, current Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko can't just cede the problematic provinces, since Ukrainian nationals argue too much land has already been ceded to Russia. The result? Long-term limbo, making Putin the winner by default.
This is the Affluent Retirement Community Where the Las Vegas Shooter Lived by Elizabeth O'Brien and Alicia Adamchik. Sun City is a sunny slice of paradise where retirees enjoy golf and the company of other older adults in a scenic desert community. It also was the home to Stephen Paddock, 64, the suspected gunman behind the Las Vegas shooting that left more than 50 people dead Sunday night. Paddock lived in the 55-plus retirement community in Mesquite, Nevada, about 80 miles outside of Las Vegas, according to news reports. The community boasts an 18-hole golf course that winds through picturesque desert mesas, indoor and outdoor pools, and a sprawling community clubhouse. "People are very friendly," says Doug Morgan, 71, who moved to Sun City from Washington State last June with his wife, Joyce. The two enjoy swimming, hiking, and having coffee with fellow residents. "I joke to my wife, I need to go get a job so I can rest." Morgan says he didn't know Paddock, who lived about a half mile away. "We moved here, ironically, because this community has one of the lowest crime rates in the state of Nevada," Morgan says, adding that he and his wife always felt safe in Sun City. Sun City properties start at $199,990, according to the website. Paddock bought his 2,018-square-foot home there in January 2015 for $369,000, according to the Las Vegas Review-Journal. He reportedly lived with his girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley, whom officials have said was out of the country at the time of the shooting. Nevada, which has no state income tax, is a popular destination for retirees. Much remains unknown about Paddock and his motivation. He lived in a community that actively fosters connections between residents, whether through an organized pool party, a pickup game of bocce, or pickleball. And yet, social isolation remains a common characteristic of mass murderers, says Mark Safarik, a retired FBI criminal profiler. The isolation becomes greater and greater until there's a breaking point. Middle and older age mass murderers have typically taken stock of their lives and concluded that they failed in their work, their finances, or their personal relationships, says Safarik. You're not in the place you thought you would be. A spokeswoman for Pulse Group, which owns Sun City, called the incident truly a tragic situation and directed further inquiries to officials in charge of the active investigation. Authorities believe Paddock killed himself.
Jagmeet Singh was elected leader of Canada's leftist New Democratic Party, the NDP, Sunday, becoming the country's first non-white leader of a major political party. capturing 53.6% of the vote. The 38-year-old Sikh will face off against current Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberals in the 2019 federal election, The New York Times reports. Thank you, New Democrats. The run for Prime Minister begins now. Hashtag love and courage, Singh tweeted Sunday. Singh claimed a decisive victory over three other candidates and will replace outgoing leader Thomas Mulcair, who has headed the party since 2012. Trudeau congratulated Singh on Twitter, writing, "I look forward to speaking soon and working together for Canadians." Born to Indian immigrants and raised in Ontario, the former criminal defense lawyer is known for his charismatic personality and colorful turbans with great appeal to younger voters. In September, a video from a campaign event, Jagmeet and Greet, went viral after a woman interrupted Singh's speech, accusing him of trying to impose Sharia law in Canada and being in bed with the Muslim Brotherhood. Singh, who is not a Muslim but Sikh, was praised for his composed response. "You know, growing up as a brown-skinned, turbaned, bearded man, I've faced things like this before. It's not a problem. We can deal with it," he said. "There are going to be obstacles we're going to face, and we're going to face them with what? Love and courage," he said to the audience. The NDP is Canada's third largest party in Parliament, and Singh was touted as someone who could reinvigorate the party after it lost 59 seats in the 2015 elections. "To make progress on these issues, to truly make Canadians' lives better, we owe it to Canadians to form government," Mr. Singh said in his acceptance speech. "We owe it to them." John Oliver wants to get tough on crime. Or as he calls it, that thing that was almost solved by a flasher dog in the 1980s. On Last Week Tonight, he turns his attention to the use of forensic evidence in trials. Forensics, like bite marks, fingerprints, hair analysis, and DNA, are a staple of TV crime shows, and Oliver has the mashup of CSI and Law & Order to prove it. But the truth is that aside from DNA evidence, which is considered the gold standard, forensics aren't nearly as reliable as TV shows would have you believe. Despite that, the shows have led to a so-called CSI effect in court cases where jurors expect forensic evidence to be presented. However, forensic evidence isn't always available, and when it is, it can be, and is, frequently analyzed incorrectly. According to Oliver, a recent survey of 268 cases where FBI hair analysis led to a conviction revealed that 96% of them had errors in analysis, and 9 of the people convicted had already been executed. You would expect FBI hair analysis to have a higher rate of accuracy than your friend's hair analysis that you can totally pull off bangs, because you can't. You absolutely can't, says Oliver. Despite the wobbly science, judges often allow evidence in based on precedent. So if a particular discipline was admitted into evidence before, judges are likely to admit it again, even if it's not necessarily good science. According to Oliver, it creates a vicious cycle where the decisions about the validity of science are being made by people who don't necessarily understand it. It's like a cooking competition for toddlers, hosted by a stray cat and judged by goats, says Oliver. States are beginning to act to protect criminal defendants from faulty forensics. Texas has passed a so-called junk science law that would let convicts appeal their convictions if the science used to convict them is proved faulty. Oliver was surprised that Texas was leading the nation in the field. You expect Texas to lead the nation in remembering the Alamo and naming their children football, says Oliver. To educate jurors about the realities of forensic science, Oliver created his own forensic TV show, starring Josh Charles as CSI Crime Scene Idiot, with support from Shannon Woodward, Josh Lucas, Bobby Burke, and Samira Wiley.
FEMA chief slammed for calling Puerto Rico relief efforts the most logistically challenging event, by Kevin Liu. Twitter users criticized FEMA Administrator Brock Long in droves Sunday after he called the disaster relief effort on Puerto Rico following Hurricane Maria the most logistically challenging event for the U.S. Long made the comment on Fox News Sunday when asked whether it was appropriate for acting Homeland Security Chief Elaine Duke to call the relief effort a good news story. The bottom line is, this is the most logically challenging event the United States has ever seen, and we've been moving and pushing as fast as the situation allows, he told host Chris Wallace. Long's comments attracted scorn on Twitter, where many pointed out that the U.S. had managed many complex logistical arrangements decades before. Many comments pointed to past U.S. military action, citing World War II battles that America was involved in or the Berlin airlift as examples. Others cited the moon landings and manned space missions as examples of the U.S. managing to pull off intense logistical arrangements. Some suggested that the Trump administration's pre-disaster planning efforts, more than anything else, were at fault. It's not only a logistically complex event, just getting to the islands and being able to support an island that was hit not just by one major hurricane, but two within basically a 10-day period, Long said when Wallace followed up on the logistical complexity comment. Puerto Rico has been struggling to recover from the devastation wrought by Hurricane Maria, which hit the island almost 2 weeks ago, causing widespread flooding and wiping out the territory's power grid. The federal government has been slammed for its response to the disaster, which many on the island have called inadequate, while President Donald Trump has engaged in a series of Twitter attacks on the mayor of San Juan, who had called on him to help. Discover George Carlin's foolproof system for organizing ideas by Lily Rothman. Now that they're part of comedy history, it can be hard to imagine George Carlin's most famous routines as anything but finished products. Whether the infamous seven words from his album Class Clown, released exactly 45 years ago Friday, or the monologues from his hosting of the first ever episode of Saturday Night Live, which returns for its 43rd season this Saturday, these routines can seem to have sprung fully formed from his mind. But there's plenty of physical evidence to the contrary. When the legendary comedian died in 2008, his daughter Kelly was left with three storage units. Among the papers and artifacts he saved were file folders that provide a glimpse into how his mind works. Those documents were acquired in 2016 by the National Comedy Center, which is scheduled to officially open in the summer of 2018 and will thus be available to the public. Seeing how his system worked is enough to inspire anyone not to let thoughts go to waste, notes Carlin estate archivist Logan Heftel. A good idea, Heftel, says Carlin learned early, is not of any use if you can't find it. That motto came directly from Carlin's boss at his first radio job, Heftel explains, along with the instruction to write down every idea he had. Over time, Carlin formalized that system. Paper scraps with words or phrases would each receive a category, usually noted in a different color at the top of the paper, and then periodically those scraps would be gathered into plastic bags by category, and then those bags would go into file folders. Though he would later begin using a computer to keep track of those ideas, the basic principle of findability remained. That's how he built this collection of independent ideas that he was able to cross-reference and start to build larger routines from, Heftel explains. In some cases, Heftel has been able to draw a direct line between Carlin's notes and his finished routines. For example, a note in a bag marked Death contained the phrase, "I saw him just the other day," which is clearly linked to a joke that was included in his last HBO special, It's Bad for You. In other cases, it's impossible for an outsider to guess what inspired the note or where it led. Nevertheless, Heftel says, the notes tend to stick close to the major themes of Carlin's work. Big ideas, the minutiae of everyday life, and then language. But the notes can also be seen as more than a way to reverse engineer, as Heftel puts it, a Carlin joke. There's also a reminder from the comedian that time is valuable and finite. The ideas we have can slip away if they're not pinned down, and record keeping that can only be deciphered by the record keeper is useless after we're gone. It certainly makes me want to improve my own record keeping and organization, he says. I think there's a lot people can learn, not just about building a comedy routine, but about approaching mortality honestly. There's a real sense of impermanence in all of what he saved. Where You Should Road Trip Based on Your Zodiac Sign by Karen Ruffini for Travel and Leisure. You've probably heard ad nauseum that it's not always about the destination, but the journey that leads you there. And while you may roll your eyes upon hearing it for the umpteenth time, there's a lot of truth in that often overused statement. Packing up the car and hitting the road can be just as thrilling as hopping on a plane. There are endless roads that will inspire even the most skeptical of travelers. The only issue? Figuring out exactly which journey is right for you. Instead of closing your eyes and choosing wherever your finger ends up pointing on a map, trust that your astrological sign will take you where you need to be. Your zodiac sign often reveals a lot about your personality, so let it guide you to the trip best suited to your likes and dislikes before plugging a foreign destination into your GPS. Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th. A Capricorn knows that practicality is key, but balancing it with adventure and exploration is necessary to maintain a happy life. The Salmon River Scenic Byway, which runs along Idaho's Salmon River, is the perfect blend of pragmatism and spontaneity. This picturesque drive starts in Stanley, Montana, and imitates the journey of Lewis and Clark, evoking history and nostalgia for this earth sign. Feed your daring side and stop at the Sunbeam Hot Springs, one of the most popular hot springs in the region. Get back on course and end your journey in Darby, Montana, where the scenic Bitterroot Mountains will surely take your breath away. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th. Aquarians thrive when they're out of their element. They're excited by the idea of unfamiliar landscapes, which is why the Blue Ridge Parkway is the ideal spot for this independent sign to take the wheel. Starting in Virginia and snaking its way through North Carolina, this 469-mile parkway is famous for its dramatic foliage during the changing seasons. Give your legs a stretch when you reach the Lynn Cove Viaduct, a 1,243-foot bridge that guides you around Grandfather Mountain in North Carolina. It's here that visitors are encouraged to take the mile-long hike under the viaduct for a unique perspective. End your trip at the Great Smoky Mountains, a marvelous sub-range of the Appalachian Mountains. Pisces, February 19th to March 20th. Ever the dreamer, this water sign thrives in the wonders of nature, especially around any body of water, which is why California's Pacific Coast Highway is a trip sure to impress a Pisces. One of the most scenic drives in the U.S., this highway gives you coastal views throughout the entirety of its 600-plus miles. Travel over the Bixby Bridge to take in the sights of Big Sur, and make sure you hit up famous places like Malibu, Los Angeles, and San Diego to max out on blissful pit stops. Aries, March 21st to April 19th. An Aries just wants to have fun in life, and what better way to do so than getting your kicks on the famous Route 66? This legendary road spans from Chicago, Illinois, all the way to Los Angeles, California, and has some of the most iconic pit stops in the country. Bask in pure Americana as you drive past endless diners and dives that play up their prime locations, but don't forget to stop and take in the awe-inspiring natural sights, such as the Ozarks, covering both Missouri and Oklahoma, and the Grand Canyon in Arizona, where 400 of Route 66's 2,000-plus miles are located. Taurus, April 20th to May 20th. Laid back and in no hurry, Tauruses love to enjoy things on a grand scale, and Montana's Yellowstone country will give the maximum pleasure with minimal effort. With almost 400 miles to navigate and not an unattractive view anywhere you turn, this road trip dips through Yellowstone Park and spills into the sights of Stillwater River, Paradise Valley, and the well-known Roosevelt Arch. Pull over to gaze in awe at Montana's highest peak, Granite Mountain, which will surely give some perspective to the warm-hearted Taurus who's taking in the once-in-a-lifetime sight. Gemini, May 21st to June 20th. Symbolized as twins, a Gemini's dual personality craves both thrills and challenges, which is why Colorado's San Juan Skyway is the perfect match for this air sign. Nicknamed the Million Dollar Highway, it's best known for its incredible views, but it was actually named for the copious amounts of precious metals that were carried through its trails in the late 1800s. Don't let this jaw-droppingly scenic road trip fool you, though. The winding mountain roads are not for the faint of heart. Take a pit stop at Mesa Verde National Park for an eerie sense of history and see ghost towns reminiscent of the Wild West. Cancer, June 21st to July 22nd. As a sign that values the beauty of nature, a nurturing Cancer needs to be driving with the windows down and the sun shining. No road trip will wow this water sign quite like a tour of Hawaii's Big Island. Sure, you may have to take a plane to get there, but once you reach Ka'alua Kona, rent a car and begin your journey across this incredible island. Before you end up at one of the Big Island's beautiful beaches, drive the Chain of Craters Road, a 20-mile trip through Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. There, you'll find yourself at the Kilauea Volcano, the most active of current shield volcanoes on the Big Island. End up at Magic Sands Beach, Hunnels Beach, or Kamakahonu Beach. Does it really even matter when each stretch of shoreline is as beautiful as the next? Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd. With a palpable energy that cannot be tamed, Leos have a flair for the dramatic, which is why Florida's Overseas Highway is the perfect trip for this rambunctious sign. Easily one of the most scenic drives in the country, the bulk of this journey is over water, allowing for incredible views no matter where a road tripper turns. The Florida Keys 7-mile bridge is a seriously impressive piece of architecture. Upon viewing, one can immediately understand why it's been used in so many films, Too Fast, Too Furious, and License to Kill being just a few. Of course, make sure your trip coincides with a sunrise or a sunset, where you'll witness an unforgettable color palette that will stop even the most hurried of travelers in their tracks. Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd. A Virgo needs a constant source of entertainment in order to avoid boredom during a long trip. Traveling down the coast of Maine along U.S. Route 1 is a surefire way to keep this Earth sign's attention. With 65 lighthouses, picturesque boating towns, and pristine parks, a road trip down this coast will occupy even the most listless of travelers. Don't miss Bar Harbor, a town located on Mount Desert that serves as the first step into the gorgeous Acadia National Park. Libra, September 23rd to October 22nd. With a mind that strives to stay tranquil and at peace, a Libra needs a trip that is filled with large doses of nature's beauty. The drive from Portland, Oregon to Redwood National Park, California, will complement this air sign's calming demeanor. Take your time as you drive down U.S. 101 South Oregon Coast Highway and detour to check out the Oregon Caves, natural marble caves that look like they're truly from another world. If tree-hugging is more your speed, you'll be rewarded tenfold when you reach Redwood National Park, which is home to the tallest trees on Earth. Driving through 40 miles of rugged coastline will provide enough zen for decades to come. Scorpio, October 23rd to November 21st. With a love for the outdoors and a determined spirit, it's time for Scorpios to pack their parkas and drive the Alaska Highway. Once described as one of the most challenging construction projects since the Panama Canal, this 1,300-mile marvel offers not only a unique journey, but a glimpse into what feels like another universe. Keep your sights on Ketchikan, a cozy Alaskan city that offers Native American culture alongside snow-capped mountains. Here, spotting wildlife like wolves and bald eagles is the norm, enough to impress even a Scorpio. Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st. Much like the centaur that represents their astrological sign, Sagittarians are constantly on the hunt for learning new things. Driving the Oregon Trail will offer endless mental stimulation for this fire sign. Follow in the footsteps of past pioneers from the Oregon coast all the way to the sandy shores of Massachusetts. Expect to see Mount Rushmore, Niagara Falls, and the Great Lakes on this 3,300-mile cross-country journey. This article originally appeared on travelandleisure.com. The reason why Fox Sports isn't airing the NFL's national anthem today, by David Z. Morris. Fox Sports says it will not air the national anthem for most of Sunday's NFL games. Last week, following critical comments from President Donald Trump, hundreds of players and other team staffers kneeled before or during the anthem in solidarity with ongoing protests against U.S. police violence as a rebuke to the president. Those player protests continued Sunday morning before a game in London between the Miami Dolphins and New Orleans Saints. But Fox told Sports Illustrated that the London game is the only one that will air the anthem on TV. Fox said in a statement that its decision not to air the anthems is standard procedure for regional broadcasts, though many of last week's player protests were broadcast live. Fox's statement also said, however, that our cameras are always rolling and we will document the response of players and coaches on the field. As of early Sunday afternoon, it was unclear how the network will document the protests without airing the anthem. How to strike the right editorial balance on this issue, acknowledging the protests without dwelling on them, was a major topic of debate for broadcasters even before this season started. There's evidence that the protests, inaugurated last year by former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, are contributing to slumping NFL viewership numbers, though team owners and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell have shown a united front in defending players' right to use the anthem as a platform for political dissent. As Fortune detailed last week, the league can afford to take the moral high ground because broadcasters like Fox are locked into long-term contracts for the right to broadcast games. As ratings decline, it's Fox, NBC, CBS, and ESPN that stand to lose hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising, while the league itself is somewhat insulated. That might motivate Fox to downplay the protests in its broadcasts. But even that would be unlikely to have a dramatic positive effect on ratings. In surveys far predating last week's explosion of protests, viewers have cited player protests as just one among a variety of reasons for tuning out, with concussions, domestic abuse scandals, and weak games almost as important as of last year. Tina Brown remembers S.I. Newhouse, Jr. Brown's memoir, The Vanity Fair Diaries, will be published in November. In the summer of 1995, S.I. Newhouse, chairman of Condé Nast Publications, offered me a lift back to the office in his limo from the Four Seasons restaurant in Manhattan after our monthly lunch to talk about the progress of Vanity Fair. It was my second year as editor-in-chief, entrusted by him with the mission to save the magazine from its disastrous and embarrassing 1983 launch. Small, shy, and nebbishy, Cy, then 57, was the only power that counted at Condé Nast. To show his true mettle, he'd had to wait until the death in 1979 of his hard-charging entrepreneurial father, Sam, who built the family fortune by acquiring a monopoly of newspapers. While Cy's brother Donald ran the newspaper assets, Cy always had an affinity for magazines. He loved them. He read them, every page of the ones he owned, and always picked out the best piece or the worst, the hidden jewel or the one you hoped you got away with, and critique it with precision. Once he took over as chairman, he went on an acquisition and startup spree that would turn Condé Nast into a prestige powerhouse. What was unique and most endearing about Cy was that he never felt or behaved like a media mogul. As we drove back to the office in his limo that summer day in 1985, he suddenly said, "You know, there's no such thing as real power in America." "What do you mean?" I said to his profile, which was gazing out the window. "Well," he said, "the president has no power. Congress can thwart him. And media power? I'm supposed to have media power, but I can't get arrested." "Of course you have power," I said, "but you sometimes choose not to exercise it." But how could I exercise it? He said, turning toward me as we cruised down Madison Avenue toward the building he owned. Say I wrote a memo to the magazine editors telling them only to plug Random House books. They'd just take no notice. Or say I gave Random House a list of books by authors I told them to buy. Well, it wouldn't last 5 minutes. We were now out of the car, walking past a newsstand stacked with all the magazine titles he owned. He stopped to wait for the elevator. As for the New Yorker, well, I find it very hard to get William Shawn on the phone, he said. With that, he disappeared, with hunched shoulders and his creased reflective face, into the express elevator to the 14th floor. And yet, look at what this modest man achieved. He was a publishing force whose religion was quality, whose taste and ambition led him to assemble a roster of some of the best editors in America and gave them the resources to do their best work without interference. He was both the Irving Thalberg of magazines and a character out of James Thurber. He was the great anti-hero of media whose passing every writer and editor and reader should mourn. Brown was editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair from 1983 to 1992. She then became editor of The New Yorker and later founded TheDailyBeast.com. The Vanity Fair diaries will be published in November. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.